Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Stacey Waite, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Jeff Oakes. Jeff Oakes is the author of two chapbooks, The Unknown Country and The Moon of Books. He's published poems in such literary magazines as Plowshares, Seneca Review, and Bloom. A recipient of three Pennsylvania Council on the Arts fellowships, he teaches poetry and manages the Pittsburgh Contemporary Writers Series at the University of Pittsburgh. How you doing, Jeff?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So you're going to be reading to us from a chapbook that you're working on most recently, right?
Yep. I have a brand new chapbook.
Okay. Great. Let's hear some of the poems.
The first poem is a poem called Strawberries. The chapbook has a lot to do with the end of a relationship. Strawberries is sort of one of those poems that gave me the signal. Strawberries. Hydroencephalic, red-faced, what seems like a head, look at the thousand gold eyes, isn't. Eat it. It revives the dead. It's the runners, the thing thinking, testing, reaching out, sinking, new roots, while you're not paying attention, saying something to a man who should have been listening, maybe, rather than assuming, since his life's fine, no one else would want to run. This next poem is a dream poem. Dream at the end of it. Think sunflower or Peru, the molten core of the conquistadors. Aren't we all the children of sunburn when we wake up at the end of a long hunger? Once I woke up as a cheetah. I ran. Think desert saints, the cinnamon of angels, immense springtimes on the tongues of Europe. How would you sing? For months, the ground underneath was such a dull, dull affair in the hot sun, a saffron dryness, an ache as miners come to know. I tried to find the horizon, but alas, I was sure the sun had stopped. Wild embers in my veins, a din like castanets that were the lilies of the field being devoured. I ate the locust I found, each little kick with a drop of black oil in its jaws. There was a flame and rustle like tiny curtains being ironed. What had I begun as, I asked myself. When the voice came to me, when I heard first the baby's cry, or was it the screech of brakes, or the breaking up of ice in an abandoned glass of tea with lemon, I stopped. Something was in it, the way a saxophone depends on the lips. Was it someone? The sun nearby was destroying an orchard for its resemblances, its fruit. What would the gazelles eat now, I thought, and saliva caught in my throat. And a singing ran in me suddenly. If it wasn't green, let it be orange or gold or bronze at least. Let there be an answer I might bring down before I woke, I thought, even as I woke, in the house where a decision had been made to call moving men, to stop singing my little misery songs, my little pitiful selves to sleep night after night. Here was the horizon, I said, and opened my eyes just as, in the dream, the thing I was would have clamped down hard on the windpipe of the antelope, child, lover, who had wandered out to see what it was, if not wind moving the hot grasses, and I stood there until it stopped moving. And then this next poem is about a kind of car that I kept feeling like was pushing me off the road night after night. So it's called The Hummer Psalm. Lord, array me, armor me. O Lord of comfortable chambers, eternal overhead lighting. Lord of silver cup holders and global positioning systems. Lord, let me not take humility so far it becomes pride. Let me not hide my halogen self under a fiberglass or aluminum grillwork. Let my lights blind my enemies and illuminate the nervous drivers beneath me, desperate to get home, afraid of the night. Lord, you are my power steering, my anti-lock brakes, my bulletproof windows, my automatic airbag, my awesome engine. If I have doubt, let me remember your easy handling, your smooth engineering. I have chosen the oxblood interior and the optional sunroof to remember your sacrifices and your distance. Let me disappear into your amenities. Lord above me, let me come to understand the difficulty of negotiating the soul's busy traffics. Lord of the mountain and the void, I fill up my tank every day in your honor. The gas station manager blesses me for it, and so blesses you. Lord, I know the day of destruction is coming. You prepare me. I understand nothing but where you drive me.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Stacey Waite, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Jeff Oakes. Jeff, one of the things I'm really interested in your work and really compelled by is the sort of the both-at-onceness of, I'm thinking of that dream poem you read, where there's a series of instructions like telling us, like, think this or imagine this, but there's also this, like, questioning. So we have both, like, these poems that have this, like, sort of assertiveness or declarative, but then also this hesitancy or this, like, very questioning or uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, I don't know how conscious that is on your part, but I find it really interesting that in terms of both things happening at once. And I was wondering if that's something that you're conscious of or something that evolves in process.
It's probably something that's evolved in process. I also think it's probably a product of becoming middle-aged, in which I feel in certain ways compelled to keep doing certain kinds of things to keep my mortgage paid for and my house, my dog fed and all that other stuff. At the same time, still having the kind of dreams of childhood and ambitions of adolescence and all those other kinds of things, which for me were mostly natural ones, so were mostly descriptive.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also that, like, the both-at-onceness of, like, the narrative and the lyrical, the sound.
Yeah.
There are times in the poems where I feel like the sound's really leading, and then other moments where the story steps in and leads for a moment, or the image, but then back to sound.
Yeah.
And you seem to have a really intricate relationship to sound. And it does have something to do with your interest in form, or?
Thank you. Actually, it has to do, especially sound has been important lately. Partly, I have a very good friend, poet Sharon McDermott, who's a musician. One of the things I've always loved about her poems is how musical they are. And I thought, you know, she grew up with music all around her. I grew up listening to, Top 40. That was my musical. I had virtually no musical education. And probably about 10 years ago, I decided I was going to force myself to start doing sound experiments. So I'd take, for instance, I'd only let myself use the long E sound for like 10 lines, or I would make myself write as many lines as I could using only O sounds. They could be long or short.
Right.
Until I just got a sense of like how to make meaningful things that also sounded.
Yeah. I'm always happy when I hear poets still using like giving themselves exercise and assignments. I think that's it's a good way. It's a good way to go to keep yourself writing like as a daily practice.
Yeah.
Or, that's great.
Yeah. The trick is always to find out things you don't know, which is always hard.
Yeah. Great. Will you read us some more poems?
Sure. March Sonnet. There is so little to praise some days. A little spurt of green among spring debris. You cling to it, a rung among the wrongs you otherwise feel. To say then that song occurs, appears, begins would be another lie. I certainly didn't hear one until I began to write this, tapping out syllables on my fingertips. After weeks of raininess, not even Eliot's, or is it Chaucer's, cruel lilacs, to start the cry that means something's finished. Oh, nothing is finished, although we try, 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 as Hopkins might have said. Still, moaning isn't an answer anymore either. Nothing's pure may be a better thing to say, by which I mean to write, to get beyond enduring it. The equipage. That there are bees in my azaleas, despite the news of hives collapsing. Begin again. Branches of hot pink feathers, fistfuls of fluted champagne, each a barn door open for the horse's return. Inside, the smell of oats, of sugar waiting. Let winter be over, the careful tethering of hope. No room for tears among the Shriners and their tiny circling vehicles. The bees are in the dresses of the desperate debutantes, hearing bells, imagining candles lit for Easter, each orange shrine a miracle. Meanwhile, a tiny map of Pittsburgh etching itself inside them, a dance to return with. Among the white and green pantaloons of the blueberry bushes, a nudge will open, a tongue will flash forward. So the oranges grow, the peach fuzz depends on, the cherries sing about before they harden. So, during a time of war, the heart finds a strange mercy still, a tiny hat, a gold coat full of messages. Sunglassed, humming, complicated mouths full of pins, forks, kazoos, full of implements, these hungry priestesses imitate the bear that will eat them, that gives them reason, that steals their drunk. Then off to answer riddle with Koan, to plumb the morning glories. Like tiny cattle, they beat the pink, fleshy silks into batter. They fall upon it like rain, their transistors turned up full for the carrying on, away. Begin again. Bring wheelbarrows for the hell of it. It rubs off. Bring the horses to harness. Unwrap the footman. This poem is about a childhood experience I had. I grew up in upstate New York, and every so often we had to burn out the caterpillars. It's called The Old War. Moth and petal, the orchard sighs. The trees are bored. The living go on dying. The boy brings another stick with a rag on it to the apple branches where the ugly gauzes, the complicated tents of the tent caterpillars, billow and smoke like an old harem in the hands of a new king, charred black bodies falling. The flame is a strange color. The color is a texture. The smoke catches and escapes the branches. The blue sky swallows it after. Each little hunger goes under the boy's sneaker, a small kind of pleasure, that pressure he makes, a sign from the living to the other kind of living that it is not wanted, not any of its libraries remain after, not a chamber, not the furthermost penthouse where sometimes an apple might remain out of reach, halfway to Mars otherwise. The boy and the flame move among them, patient, deliberate, careful not to burn the leaves left, the little fruit, just a touch of the furious heat and the beddings and the curtains, the tablecloths and the rugs, all the spun houses. Now he needs two hands. He is getting tired, veil after veil lifted, lifting, and later he will taste it in the cotton candy he eats and think of it in the fireworks over the fields at the edge of town where space is made for celebration, cakes, pies for a price, the firemen ready for the falling ash to surprise them, hoping, maybe. The old men still looking for Sputnik. That evening they did. How everything was changed. This is sort of a newish poem that insects show up in all these poems. And this time it's praying mantises. And it's for my friend Amy Knapp. The Little Killers. In Constantinople, the dust has two colors. One tastes like oranges, the other starfish. Anything has its calamities to bear, its sandpaper to mourn, its violins. What did the discovery of the tiny mantids at the edge of the garden of my ordinary row house have to do with the diagnosis of a friend with cancer? The same day in which the newspaper announced yet another city lost to us. I stood there with my shovel while she told me the various best case, worst case scenarios. Nothing but trouble, honestly. Not a skeleton key appeared for all I'd planted, not a phone call of relief. At Mount St. Michel, we'd climbed higher and higher together. She was so much heavier then, and at night snored me out of my bed. What is the name of the willow in France? It doesn't matter what kind of wood you imagine. The hose dripped near the faucet, as always, in the shadows between the houses. What was left to water? Everything had had enough. One of those days. What were her choices but to believe the doctors growing younger, to believe in a get-out-of-jail ticket? What was my small thing of a heart doing but beating and counting the beats, the little killers in the rhubarb doing but devouring aphids like flank steaks, aiming to live as fiercely as was necessary among the raspberries we bought for next to nothing when we returned from Paris, transformed?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Stacey Waite, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Jeff Oakes. Jeff, you mentioned a lot of the poems being about insects, and I noticed, too, some of the other ones, like dogs and animals appearing, and I'm interested in hearing about, like, in what ways those, it's sort of like they carry the wisdom of the poems, or it seems like. Is that, yeah. Are you thinking of them as, like, this kind of mirror, or?
Yeah. I mean, one of the cliches in the sort of old romantic version, I think, of poetry is that birds and flowers carry the message from God or from greater spirits or something. So certainly I'm sort of working against that. But for me, it was reality seems much harder. And if there is something like God, that it probably is closer to those things that have lived longest. Mm-hmm. And insects seem like that to me.
It makes them wise. They've been around for a while.
Exactly. They're the point at which, they know the most, if they know anything.
Do you also think there's anything about, like, how small they are or, like, the intricacy of?
Yeah, I have loved them. I mean, truthfully, if I hadn't become a poet, I probably would have become a scientist who studied insects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A bug guy.
I've always loved them. And as a kid, I was really ruthlessly cruel in certain, like, I would throw ants into spider webs and just sit and watch it, watch the whole thing
watch
happen.
Watch the process
There was something
happen.
About that I just could watch for hours.
Have you written that poem?
No, I tried to write it as a story once.
I'm like, you should write that poem with the spider web and the little kid watching the spider web.
Yeah, there's a poem that I've never quite finished. I've been writing almost all my life about burning ants with a magnifying glass too, which I think I have to be older and able to deal with my own cruelty.
With your own,
which is the hard part, I think, about writing those poems.
Yeah, but important, I think, part of the work. That's great.
Yeah.
Good. You want to read us some more poems?
Sure. This next poem... is actually this is one of those poems that I think of as sort of I wrote from middle age back to my students who would be my children's age if I had children, and thinking about the kinds of changes that I have seen just in 40 some years. The telephones. Some were square, like the heads of Labrador retrievers. The furniture then had to be heavy enough to support them, which is why you have no forests. Each phone weighed the same as a grown man or a woman in labor. Its ring alone could break dishes left out to dry. Those dark anchors we had to heft, black as a nun's bed or a gun's chamber just before the click. Only some of us were strong enough to lift those black barbells up to our ears. Remember, this was when we used to take baths only once in a while, when Dial soap might last months on the shelf. Called a cake then, it was your reward for swearing certain oaths. What water we bathed in came out of what we called a cistern, a stone vault below the house where rain collected and was redirected by lead pipes upward. When you got bored counting birds, you could go down and watch shards of light slowly circle in it. Water without wind, sometimes so quietly you might mistake its being full as being empty. We washed in that, yes, left what was hot sometimes for another body to soak and cool in. If you were lucky, no one else walked in on you to say there was still more work to do, mowing the enormous lawn, cleaning the side windows. When those phones rang, you could hear them way out in the pear trees, way out near the blackberried fences where the trains blew warnings, loud and smoky, as if the telephone had conjured them, as it could the fire truck, the ambulance, the police, the hearse's silence. Sometimes when it rained, you could, if you did it very lightly, lift up the receiver from its cradle and hear one neighbor complain about another, which meant you could be overheard too. Black radio, black toad waiting to sing, part cast iron skillet, part oven. It demanded we stay put, sit, when we talk to one another. Our ears hurt after a while. To call out, we stuck our fingers into it and dialed until we heard it click, then a ring on the other side. In the winter, if the power went out, sometimes we had to dial in the dark and pray. We didn't always know then what we were calling people away from, so we had to have something to say. People had things to do every day. If phones rang at night, you knew it was death, and you hesitated before saying hello. Black thundercloud, bear waiting asleep in the cave. You might swear on one in the absence of a Bible. Those were the days we killed oxen and roasted them whole in pits. Big chunks of charred meat came piled on a platter, and you ate it. You ate and you ate and you ate those days. You had to be strong because everything was made for the strong. This was when there was wilderness you could still get lost in. Way before your little phones started chirping, there are ironic jingles everywhere. We had little choice. Everything was either black or metal. Satellites watched us. Sometimes people called you just to hear them breathe.
I think I would have believed my grandfather if instead of saying he went uphill both ways to work, if he had written that poem instead.
Yeah, no, that's in fact, it's partly that poem is I tried to reinvent the voice of my grandparents who always told us about the Depression, and we always sort of laughed in their faces because we couldn't believe any of it. And now I'm trying to like sort of reinvent the tall tale.
Yeah,
in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, interesting poem.
This is a poem that's another. It's partly a relationship poem. It's also a poem that's a kind of form poem. And I tried to in every – it's made up of 4 or 5-line stanzas. And every stanza, my rule was I had to use every single letter of the alphabet at least once.
Wow. Okay.
The Kingfisher. Zero is not dead. And when it is blue, will not be what the ocean makes of things, despite you. Can't put it in a jar, assuming the same light will follow. It might, but without quite those savage exhalations which lead us to metaphor. Your foot turned kingfisher blue where the ocean surprised it, or the tick of my watch by that pond, like lapis lazuli, dashing us both underwater. The joke's inexact quaver, a deep fear of turtles. So deep an azure which one of us will believe that old half-fallen birch is the launching point of questions, the exacting why me's, those injuries that twitch among the thistles, creeks, the mushroom bulbs. Another beginning comes. Down eventually floats, gravity hardly involved, just kicked loose. Many new opportunities promise quicksilver results, surprises. The truth, except you, each song's like something in a zoo. This next poem is a part of a series that I'm working on right now that is really weird to me. I'm calling them all errata, which is a term, right, that you see in books. That is often the very first thing that you'll see in a book that will tell you ahead of time that there are already mistakes in the book that you're reading. And I've always hated them. But there's a kind of interesting – I'm very interested in the idea of mistakes and sort of transformations and sort of accidental transformations. So this is one of the errata poems. Upending for unending. Dementia for divergent. In the girlfriend, a giant fowl. Anglo-Saxon, if you knew my husband. I envy you. Your insects. There was the deer along the road, moving away across the field with a fawn between. Lonely, beautiful, the honey dripping off them, all the crushed surprise of the roadkill on the way, like those men with big eyes, a fork, a spoon, a nicely knife, as if burning were elegy only and not fire. I mean, really. I don't understand that poem either. and in fact, that's one of the things I'm trying to do in this new work is sort of write beyond my understanding. So some of them are very weird.
Yeah.
And a lot of them actually are coming out of dream poems. So here's another dream poem. I woke up with these lines after this dream and went for this walk, sort of like that. Morning, Rock Hudson. Out of what are we made, rock and river, who do not get invited to the dinners where Sally Fields cries among the various corporate chairmen, who drink in crowds whose laughter among the paneled walls is a signal, our hidden star, stone and water, that light is over. So among the mourners, so the keening, I walk the snow-white streets with a black dog. Sometimes a dream informs me. You are mourning someone who never existed, who you made up out of nothing. The white page streets, a black pen like a Labrador.
The poetry of Jeff Oakes. Thanks so much for being here, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts and entertainment newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.